For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
The Sermon on the Mount, as we've been saying, is well, any doubt, the most well-known of all Jesus' teachings in the Gospels, and maybe the most well-known religious text in the world. And of those things that are common in our understanding that come from the Sermon on the Mount, probably nothing is more familiar than what we're going to talk about tonight, which is Jesus' discussion about God and morality. And I want to get into this question. It's an important one because it really involves three very specific questions, questions that Jesus is interacting with based upon his own historical situation, which I think in a lot of ways is not dissimilar from our own in terms of the questions that people ask. We're asking, what is the meaning of morality? When we use the term right or wrong, you know, the word good is about the most commonly used word in the English language, but what does it actually mean? What do we say when we say that something is good or that God requires of us good things, good behavior, or whatever? So we want to get into that question. We want to ask the question of what's the standard? In other words, how good do I have to be? Or in the book that we give to people who are guests with us here, free, how good is good enough? It's an important question. If you don't know the answer to that question, get our book. It costs you nothing. And then the third thing I think that is on a lot of people's mind, and certainly was on my mind before I had become a Christian, is what's the purpose of being good? What's the purpose of morality? It just seems like a lot of do this and don't do that kind of thing. But the framework that we want to talk about this in is the religious framework, and the framework that is on people's minds pretty much across cultures universally are asking questions, am I okay with God, based upon these questions of morality. And while people's moral ideas may vary from culture to culture or from religion to religion, actually, in terms of what is the meaning of religion? Well, you know, if you come from a Jewish background, you're familiar with the Ten Commandments, or if you're really observant as a Jew, the 613 moral teachings of the Old Testament, or the thousands of teachings in Rabbinic Judaism known as the Talmud. In the East, in Asia, they have the Eightfold Path of Buddhism toward enlightenment, that if you follow the path and follow it consistently, then it's possible to get released from the cycle of life. Islam has its five pillars. Every religious system, more or less, is defined by this moral framework that it obliges to the adherents of the religion with the expectation if they follow it in a certain way, with a certain amount of rigor, then they're going to be able to find right standing with God. It's pretty much what it's all about. I was just reading a news article this morning about Ted Turner. He's a pretty well-known atheist, actually, but he turned 75 this year, and his thoughts are turning to heaven and hell. And where do I go and how do I get there? It's a pretty interesting little thing on CNN.com. It's a real popular kind of thought that we tie our eternal destiny with our morality. And then along comes Jesus. And he's got a different outlook, a radical teaching, and a radical departure from this religious framework that I've been describing here tonight. And the central text on Jesus' teaching about the relationship between God's acceptance of people and morality is Matthew chapter 5, the passage that we're going to look at here tonight. So here it is. We're going to look at these three questions because these are the things that Jesus himself is interacting with to a very, very religious people. And so we'll take them in turn. The first is the true meaning of morality. What do we mean by right and wrong? What is good or bad? And here Jesus says, this is Matthew 5, verse 21, you have heard that the ancients were told, you shall not commit murder, and whoever commits murder shall be liable to the courts. But I say to you that everyone who is angry with his brother shall be guilty before the court. And so here Jesus, you know, he is claiming a pretty unique level of authority. He says, you have heard that the ancients were told, and then who does he quote? Moses. the lawgiver. He quotes him and he says, you've heard the ancients were told, you shall not commit murder. That's one of the Ten Commandments. Then he contrasts that, not contradicts it, but he contrasts it. He qualifies it on the basis of his own authority. But I say to you, and that if you read the Gospels, this is the whole deal, is that Jesus affirms the entire validity of the Old Testament. But as we'll see tonight, comes to fulfill it. And this is one of his statements that he has the authority both to express with clarity and from God himself the meaning of the law and what God's intent really was. So he goes on, he says, whoever says to his brother, you good for nothing, I have to think that was censored, shall be guilty before the Supreme Court. Whoever says, you fool, shall be guilty enough to go to hell. Wow. So that's pretty tough. He says, you've heard that it was said, you shall not commit adultery, but I say to you that everyone who looks at a woman with lust for her has already committed adultery with her in his heart. Oh, well, that's a little different. And here Jesus is making the contrast between the inner dimensions of God's moral will and the outer practice itself. You know, it's real easy to convince yourself as a religious person, or maybe just as a secular person with a moral outlook, that I'm basically pretty good. I mean, I don't, kill people, I don't rob, I don't do all these terrible things, I'm not a liar or whatever. And that may be so, and certainly in religious morality, religious ethics, the focus is always on the outside, and whether it's a system of rituals that set you apart from other people, or the narrow teaching of religion that you should do certain kinds of things, especially at certain kinds of times of day or whatever. It's outward in its focus, and Jesus has said that the real interest of God is not just sort of some outward behavior, some thing that you can manage and control that gives yourself that sort of image of being morally upright, but there's an inward dimension, and that is really what God is concerned about. I love what Isaiah the prophet says. Isaiah 29 verse 13, he says, this people draws near to me with their words and honors me with their lips, but they remove their hearts from me. Their reverence for me consists of tradition learned by rote. And so that's the religious mentality of Isaiah's day. That's 700 BC. It's the same as the religious mentality of Jesus' day. And really, if we're honest, it's the religious mentality of our own day as well, isn't it? It's just the idea that I'm trying to be good, I'm trying to keep my nose clean, trying to stay out of trouble, trying to, in some outwardly oriented way, be good. But Jesus is saying that's really not what God cares about, because God's interested in what's going on in your heart. What are the motivations that guide you and drive you? And what do you strive for? That's the kind of thing that God has in mind. So he's got that going. Then he goes on, he says, you've heard it said, you shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But I say to you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you, so that you may be sons of your Father who is in heaven. And so here is another distinction that Jesus makes, would be important in the mind certainly of his audience: the inward versus outward dimensions of morality, and then the positive versus the passive dimensions. Love your neighbor and hate your enemy is a twist on Leviticus chapter 19. The Bible doesn't teach hate your enemies. It says love your neighbors, but the rabbis by the time of Jesus' day had added to it. And basically they're like, well, who is my neighbor? My neighbor is people who like me and I like them. And so, yes, we should be obliged to love people who, well, love us. But as for people who are not our neighbor and who do not love us, then we are entitled to hate people like that. And Jesus is like, no, that's not the way it is. He says, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you. It's a totally different attitude. And it's basically saying not just the avoidance of doing bad things to somebody, but it's a call to positive, purposeful behavior on behalf of other people. It's the golden rule, which we'll talk about in a few weeks from Matthew chapter 7. Do unto others as you would want others to do unto you, which is very different than the kind of secular view of the golden rule, or the golden rule as it's taught in Taoism, for instance, in Asian religion, which says, never do anything to anyone that you wouldn't want them to do to you. Now, you see how that's different than the positive teaching, do for others what you would want others to do for you. One says, just stay out of the way. Don't interfere. Leave people alone. And so their problems are their problems, and I'm sure that they'll work it out their own way. But they're not my problems. And Jesus is saying, and in a way that's just absolutely consistent with the whole counsel of the Old Testament, which is that, no, we have a positive moral obligation to meet the real needs of other people, no matter who they are, because my neighbor is anyone who might be in a place of need. And so Jesus illustrates that, for instance, in the story of the Good Samaritan, the person who has been beat up by robbers and has been left to bleed alongside the road, and the religious people pass him by, because why? Because that's not my neighbor, right? But the Samaritan, a person hated by the religious establishment, is the one who cleans this guy's wounds, takes him to an inn, pays for his ongoing care. And Jesus is like, that's what I'm talking about. It's that there is a positive obligation to meet the needs of people in the name of God. Because why? Because people are uniquely image bearers of God. Human beings are not just biological, complex bags of chemicals. We are that, but we're more than that. And there's a basis for human dignity in the image of God. And because we are in the image of God, there's something unique and intrinsically valuable about all people, because we are in God's image. That provides a basis then to talk about civil rights, people's rights. And what Jesus is saying is that we have obligations that come living in God's world to be, in essence, his instrument in the meeting of needs of those who have them. There's a positive moral obligation here. The person who says, I'm going to retreat to the mountains and write off the rest of society, and maybe focuses on their own personal piety or something like that, is not spiritual as Jesus would define spiritual, and not a good person as the Bible would define it. Here's a person who's written off their role in the meeting of the needs of those who have them, in violation to the very core idea of this biblical notion of love. We love because God's loved us, and because we have resources to care for somebody else. So love your enemies. Pray for those who persecute you. Even people who don't deserve it, you love them anyway. People don't have to merit your acceptance. They don't have to merit having their needs met by you. You just meet them. That's the point. And then he goes on and says, if you love those, this is verse 46, those who love you, he says, well, that's great. What reward do you have? Do not even tax collectors do the same? If you greet only your brothers, what more are you doing than others? Don't even the Gentiles do the same? And so here is another dimension of this, which is, you know, this willingness of people to be selective about who do I love and who merits my attention are, of course, people who love me. But Jesus is like, no, you can go through your life with the pretense of being good by just avoiding anybody who around you might have need. He says, but there's no virtue in that. That's not that impressive. I mean, anybody can do that. And so, what he's talking about here is the religious mindset that says, I don't want to be contaminated by the world, don't want to be affected by bad people who might, you know, wear off on me or whatever. And instead, Jesus is saying, you know, we love those who don't necessarily merit our love. And that is at the heart of what it means to have the heart of God, to be one of God's people. The prime directive is love, right? The whole law, Jesus says, is summed up in the commandment to love God with your total being and your neighbor as yourself, and your neighbor is anybody who's in need. So that's pretty core and pretty central. So the meaning of morality, I think, is pretty clear from this passage. Then secondly, we turn to the question of standard. How do I know if what I'm doing is sufficient? How good is good enough? And so here he says in verse 20, I say to you that unless your righteousness surpasses that of the scribes and Pharisees, you will not enter the kingdom of heaven. And concludes the discussion in verse 48 by saying, therefore you're to be perfect as your heavenly Father is perfect. Uh-oh. We got a problem. And so, what is the true standard? How do people think about that? How good is good enough? Well, you know, in Islam, for instance, they teach the scales of justice. We just weigh the bad deeds that we do against the good deeds we do. It was probably, when we come before God, a moment of anxiety when the thing's teetering back and forth. We're remembering with regret maybe a few of the things that we did. Why did I steal that quarter from my sister's desk when I was 8? Then there was that parking place that I ditched in front of that guy and said some things I shouldn't have said. But then there were some other things too. I walked my mom across the street and she was old. And so it is with the religious mentality. We think of ourselves, well, I'm more good than I am bad. But Jesus isn't going there, if you see from what he says here. The scales don't matter. And that's not the way God interacts with our guilt or with our merit. We may congratulate ourselves with favorable comparisons. We might say, well, at least I'm no, you know, fill in the blank, Ted. I don't know. At least I'm no Ted. But then Ted says, well, at least I'm no Lef, you know. And so we got that kind of thing going on. And all this comparative religiosity that makes me feel like I'm better than some. And that's not what Jesus is saying here. I think it's pretty clear. That's not his standard. Probably the most common standard in our culture comes from Shakespeare. In Hamlet, he says, to thine own self be true. I'm the standard, right? And so years ago, I was teaching an ethics class at Ohio Dominican, and there's these students in there, and we were talking about ethics, and the subject turned to that very famous Shakespearean line, and people were interacting with, yeah, man, you got to be true to yourself, and you know, all that kind of thing, just being sincere to who you are, that's really what it's all about. And there in the back row, there's this guy who's kind of like this. I'm like, well, what do you think? And he goes, well, what if thine self is a jerk? I thought, good point. True to what? To the fact that you're a jerk? That's not okay. It's not self-authenticating just to be consistent with yourself. I like the way Paul puts it in Romans chapter 2, verse 1. He says, therefore, you have no excuse, everyone who passes judgment, for in that you judge another, you condemn yourself. The same standard that you use, that you say that you live by, you violate, and then you judge other people for doing the same thing. Hypocrisy is not just the problem of the religious, it's the problem of everybody. And so, you know, here it is. That is our moral outlook. We compare ourselves. We have all these things going on that basically helps us to boost our sense of moral, you know, self-image, saying I'm basically good. But the real standard we're ignoring, and which is Jesus's point, which is your righteousness, if you want to earn it, if that's really what the project that you are involved with, if you want to make yourself right with God, you've got a problem, because your righteousness has to be greater than the scribes and Pharisees. And these are guys, these are professional religious guys. And they would look to the Old Testament and they say, well, there's a lot of rules in there, but unfortunately, they don't have in mind every conceivable circumstance that life faces, and we need to know what to do in every circumstance in order to be right with God, to present ourselves that way. In other words, to be self-righteous. And so they wrote this thing that would later be called the Talmud, which consists of thousands of rules that try to regulate every facet of life. Thousands of them. Thousands that relate to the keeping of the Sabbath, for instance. Did you know that you shouldn't spit on the Sabbath? Because spitting on the Sabbath might hit a dirt floor, creating a furrow in which a seed might just by happenstance fall into that furrow and become fertilized, and, you know, that's agricultural activity. That's not allowed. You can't drag a chair across a room for that very same reason. And in Hasidic neighborhoods even today, you can't turn on an oven. You have to buy a Sabbath oven that you turn on a day before, and that it has just the right kind of turn on and turn off time and temperature and everything else, so that you're not working. Of course, I don't know what it means when you open the thing up and pull your food out, but in any way, the point is, you can get pretty neurotic about this kind of activity. And Jesus is just like, look, you know, let's put it like this. You have to be more attentive to morality than even the Pharisees if you want to get into the kingdom of heaven. Which basically meant in his context, nobody is going to be included. Nobody is that attentive to every thought, every deed, everything that they do. And so the peril, of course, is the idea that since I am so religious, God will be deeply impressed with my religiosity. I'm trying so hard, can't you see, to be pleasing to you, God? But Jesus has nothing but open contempt for self-righteousness. In Luke chapter 18, starting in verse 9, Jesus gives the parable. He says, of a man who trusted in himself that he was righteous while viewing others with contempt. And it says that he's standing there and he's thanking God that he's not like other people, like sinners, like our brother Bot here. Thank God I'm not like him, the parable says. You know, I tithe everything that I get and grow and everything else. And Jesus contrasts that with this guy who's clearly a sinful person, a tax gatherer, who he says was unwilling even to lift his eyes to heaven, but was beating his chest saying, God, be merciful to me, a sinner. And the parable concludes with Jesus' strong affirmation. He says, I tell you, this is the man who went to his home justified by God. This is the one in right standing before God, the humble guy who realized how far he was. And so it is for everyone who believes themselves to be righteous and views others with contempt. That's Luke chapter 18, verses 9 and following. Jesus saves his harshest words for the religious mentality. Well, there's only one true standard. He says you're to be perfect. If this is your agenda, to earn the acceptability of God on the basis of your behavior, there's really only one standard, and which is that you are to be perfect. If you diminish that standard, you're just diminishing God. And you're playing a religious game. And the reality of the matter is that is what religion is about. It's playing the game of telling myself that I'm a pious person, I try hard, and that God should be impressed by my efforts. That's religion at its core. I don't care what label you put on it. That's the universal, and this is what Jesus is opposed to. It's not where Jesus goes. And so he says, everyone, this is James chapter 2, verse 10, not 20, whoever keeps the whole law yet stumbles in one point, he says, has been become guilty of all. Yeah, so you can try real hard, but then, oh, there's that thought. Oh. Lust, covetousness, the desire to have somebody else's stuff or more. Anybody guilty there? Just me, okay, I got you. James says, whoever keeps the whole law and stumbles in one point has become guilty of the whole thing. The law is a contract. You don't have to violate every term of a contract to have violated the contract. You don't have to violate most of the terms of the contract to violate the contract. You have to violate one part of the contract. You say to yourself, well, I have paid my rent on time every month. I've never started a bonfire in my kitchen. I pay my utility bills on time. So what does it matter that I blew out the back wall? To which your landlord says, I got a problem with that. It says, no explosives in my house. That's a violation. So congratulations that you paid your bills on time. But you blew it. You violated the terms of the contract. You're guilty. And this is what Jesus is saying to these religious people. It's true you might be more pious than the next. You might be a better person relatively to the person that you're sitting beside. I know if you're standing by me, you're certainly my moral superior. I believe that. But it's not good enough. And so the standard is perfection. And Jesus could not be clearer on this point than he is right here. We know the substance of morality, what it means. It means not just some superficial avoiding of bad things, but it's a positive obligation to love, to meet the real needs of people. It has an internal dimension. It has to do with our thought life and with our motivations and what we're about, not just what's out there in our easily performable behaviors. We have a standard right here that is absolute. This ought to be making us a little nervous at this point. I think that's the intent that Jesus had. Let's move on to think about, why does he lay this out? Why does he say, okay, here's what I mean when I talk about what it is to be good, right, just. And here's the standard, folks. Why does he do this? Well, very importantly, verse 17 says, do not think that I came to abolish the law or the prophets. I did not come to abolish them. I'm not inventing a new religion here, Jesus says. I'm coming here with the message that has been here since the very beginning, since Moses himself wrote the law. In verse 18, he says, I say to you, truly until heaven and earth pass away, not the smallest letter or stroke shall pass away from the law until all of this is accomplished. I'm not walking away from what God has already revealed. I'm going to fulfill it. The original purpose of the law, let's understand this clearly, right here, right now. The purpose of the law has never been to make people a pathway to be acceptable to God. The purpose of the law in the Old Testament was never intended as a pathway to make people acceptable to God. It never says that. The purpose of the law runs in a different direction, and this is what Jesus is getting at here. He's talking about fulfilling the law, bringing it to its completion in terms of its intent, in terms of its purpose. The law exposes an unfixable problem. That's the first of two things that the law does. It exposes an unfixable problem. Romans 3:23, a very famous verse, Paul writes, "All have sinned and fallen short of the glory of God." How do we know that we've fallen short of God's glory? How do we know that we've fallen short of His standards? Because we look at the law and it calls us to something that we cannot do. It exposes our guilt. It takes that sense that we have that something's wrong, and it makes it objective. It's not just that I feel sort of out of sorts, I have this lingering sense of shame or whatever. It's that here the law tells me that I should never treat people as objects of my desire, but as ends unto themselves that I'm prepared to sacrifice for, and so forth. The law exposes an unfixable problem, and a problem that is so vast that I don't have the resources to fix it. Psalm 49, verses 7 to 9 is awesome. The psalmist says, "No man can by any means redeem his brother or give God a ransom for him, for the redemption of his soul is costly, and he should cease trying forever." He's basically saying, once you realize you're guilty, it's just too late to do anything about it. You don't have what it takes to set yourself free. Nobody does. Nobody does. But in the law, and this is the importance of what Jesus is saying here, he says, "I didn't come to abolish the standard. I'm not taking that away. But in fulfilling the law, something very important is being," he says at the end of verse 18, "accomplished." Accomplished. And what is it that the law seeks to accomplish? It is the law of atonement. Leviticus chapter 17, verse 11 says that all life, the life of the flesh is in the blood, and it has been given on the altar to make atonement for your souls. For it is the blood by reason of the life that makes atonement. And so there's a principle here embedded right in the heart of the law that assumes everyone is guilty. The law assumes that you cannot live by the provisions of the law. And so built into the law itself is this principle of atonement that says that God is prepared to offer a substitute to take upon itself the penalty of your guilt. There is a transfer of your guilt onto a substitute, and that substitute dies the death that you deserve. And so in the Old Testament, based upon this principle here in the law, there is this whole framework of sacrifices where the priest confesses the sins of himself and the people on the animal. The animal is taken, the life is taken from it. The blood is, out it comes. And that animal pays for the guilt of the people. And that principle of substitution, that principle of atonement, is something that was just etched deeply into the conscience of God's people throughout the whole Old Testament. It's the picture of, here I am, here's my guilt. My guilt results in death, alienation from God, standing under His judgment. And yet God is, in a symbolic way, through these sacrifices, saying that the solution to this problem is not to be better, it's too late for that, but for a substitute to come and to die in your place. And so when Jesus says that He's come to fulfill the law, This is what he has in view, that Christ himself, he is our sacrifice. And so if we go to verse 15 of this same psalm that we were reading, where it says that man, no man can by any means redeem himself or his brother or anybody, to think that we could do that would just be to trivialize our guilt. He says, but, one of those pregnant Old Testament but clauses. Everything's going this way. And it's bad news. But God's at work. But God will redeem my soul from the power of Sheol, for he will receive me. And how will he do this? John says, the Baptist, in John chapter 1, verse 29, behold the Lamb of God that takes away the sins of the world. He's the Lamb who offers himself in substitution for the death that you deserve. He's the fulfillment of the law. He's the one who says, I'll take upon myself the weight of all of your guilt, and the death that I die is for you, so that my life can come alive in you. And so that's the whole point of Christ. He didn't come to make us better people. He didn't teach the brotherhood of man and the fatherhood of God in some kind of a let's all hold our hands together and sing kumbaya kind of way. He's talking about something very deep and very powerful here. He's speaking to the depths of the heart of every person that everyone knows. I don't care who you are or where you are from culturally or in your experience of life, every human being, as a matter of their own mental health, recognizes that they are guilty. The people who go and say, I sense no guilt within myself, what do we call people like that? There's a term, sociopath, somebody without a conscience. And the law says, this is why you have that awareness within. It's because there is a God in whose image you are, and he has made you, designed you to live a way that you don't live. And for that reason, you are broken. And you stand under the weight of your guilt and the judgment of a just God who created you to live a different way. And everybody knows that. It's true that we may try to rationalize, we say, well, that can't be true because I've erased God from the metaphysical horizon. He's not there. There, issue resolved. No, it's not. Not at all. Now we just have no possible means to resolve our problem. Or define it even. And Jesus is coming in as the Lamb of God, not to make us better, not to rub our face in our guilt, but to draw us to an awareness, a sober awareness of how far we've drifted from God's intent, so that we would have the humility to receive from him the gift of forgiveness, grace. It is God's riches at Christ's expense. It is his offer to you here tonight. If you're here and you're thinking, I've been a good whatever it is my whole life or whatever, take note of Jesus' words. It's never good enough. That's not the agenda that God has for you. The agenda that he has for you is for you to take an honest assessment of your failings before him, confess that you are unable to fix yourself, it's way too late for that, and then with humility receive the forgiveness that he freely offers you in Jesus Christ. And so we're just offered two pathways. The religious pathway that says I'm going to try harder and do better and trust against the teachings of Jesus, that God will accept me based upon my sincerity or whatever it is. It's not very sincere to reject what he himself has said, by the way. But on the other hand, to just say, okay, I want what I can't do for myself. I want to be reconciled to you, God. I want you to just take away the burden of my guilt, and I want to be forgiven. And that's the way of grace. It's my way or his way. There's not a mixture of the two. He won't meet us halfway. There's no other deal to be formed. It's this. Will I stand upon the work of Christ on my behalf and say thank you to God? Or will I stand on the basis of my own religious performance and say, thank me very much? It's really one of the, those are really the only two ways that we're given. And Jesus says it so well in John chapter 6. He says, what shall we do the work of God? The religious were asking, well, come on, tell me, I gotta have something to do. And so Jesus is like, okay, well, whatever. Here's what you gotta do if you wanna work the works of God. How about this? Believe in him who he has sent. There you go. Your work is to believe. Believe in the total sufficiency of what I'm doing for you. That's your work, if you want to call it work. It's belief. It's trust. It's relying on what God has done for us. And so, just to bring it all to a conclusion here, there are two things that Jesus puts out here as moral priorities. The first is the kind of humility and gratitude that comes from a person who recognizes that my standing before God is totally a gift that I never deserved, I don't earn, and that calls upon me to set aside my self-righteous pride. I'm not any better than anybody else. Now, it's true, I haven't done some of the things that other people have done, but I've thought about them, and so have you, right? And under different circumstances, with different things going on, I might have done exactly that very same thing. I might stand on my soapbox and say that's really bad. And so if we understand Jesus' teaching about the law, it produces that humility that says, you know, I'm not great. It's the end of self-righteousness. And it is that the joy of a person who has received with gratitude a gift that they could never earn. And a person who is living in this way, it just flows over into this core of biblical teaching, which is about the inclusive love of God for others, regardless of whether they are our neighbor, our friend, merit our love or whatever, because God loved us even while we were so far from him. While we were still enemies, in fact, Paul says, Christ died for us. And so we just set aside that, and not about self-centered piety, not about my own keeping my nose clean and being better. But my growth morally, as it were, comes as I set aside my rights to move into the world of others to initiate sacrificial Christ-like love for their good and for their benefit. We talked a couple of weeks ago about this incredible charge that Christ gave to his people. He says, you're the salt of the earth and the light of the world. In other words, you are God's signpost saying, God can be found this way. And now he's describing what it is that people sense about God's people. That is this powerful open door to understanding how sweet God really is. It's his people who understand that their standing before God is based upon humbly receiving a gift. And so there's that sense of abiding gratitude, and because of our gratitude, just that desire to move into other people's lives and to selflessly give to them as God and through Christ has selflessly given to us. And that changes people, and it changes community, And it's a sweet indication of the reality of this message that we're talking about here tonight.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.